The Compliance Perspectives podcast is sponsored by Onspring, a no-code GRC software for compliance pros like you. Visit onspring.com to learn more. Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from Portland is Tim Timmons, Compliance and Privacy Officer at Community Counseling Solutions, and Kimberly Lindsay, Executive Director at Community Counseling Solutions. And today we're going to be talking to them about their session, Developing an Ethics and Compliance Program and Behavioral Health Programs, which they'll be giving at the 2024 Compliance Institute in Nashville. First, Kimberly, Tim, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. Kimberly, why don't we start with you? Can you start with sort of a broad overview? What are the typical compliance challenges in behavioral health? Are they very different than would be found in other healthcare settings, or largely the same?
I think that they are similar in some respects, and Tim might chime in here after I get done speaking to the first part. What are typical compliance challenges? I think that there's some similarities and some important differences. Just looking at the typical challenges that we see, first one that came to my mind when I was talking with Tim about this is managers and supervisors who are very well-intended, just extremely busy, not holding staff accountable and reporting misconduct in a timely manner. Sometimes it may seem like a small thing or insignificant. They know the person didn't intend to do it, and so it doesn't get reported. But that doesn't mean that it should be billed, or that if it did get billed, that it shouldn't get addressed and followed up on. And so how do we work with supervisors and managers to keep this at the top of their list and help them understand the importance? And Tim will talk about that a little bit later when we get into training. That's just an important, pretty important that we keep our supervisors and managers informed and treat that as a high priority. And then the second one is when we're working with people after hours in crisis situations, that can get pretty dicey. Again, you know, I think that folks are very well intended with wanting people to get better, and it's after hours, and there's a lot of adrenaline sometimes at 2 a.m. in a difficult situation, and we might share more information than what we should share. So how do we make sure that we're managing it? We're only providing information on a need-to-know basis. And if we're not sure, how do we make sure that we're talking with the appropriate people to determine whether or not we can share information? Similarly, maybe not necessarily after hours or during a crisis, what protected health information can we share with community partners who aren't involved in a client's treatment? And maybe they should be involved, or maybe a clinician knows that the information would be really valuable and helpful in the person's care. But if we don't have the right releases of information or the right criteria can't be checked, we can't share that information. Sometimes, though, it just puts us in a difficult spot, and clinicians don't always remember to go back and check the record to make sure that we have those ROIs in place. We get a lot of subpoenas and a lot of court orders, and that might be an area where we are different than healthcare, where we see a lot of requests for records and maybe medical care, but we get asked to testify on whether or not a person should have their kids, not have their kids, what their progress is like in treatment. And sometimes the court order or the subpoena that we receive is not in keeping or not compliant with 42 CFR or other relevant rules. And if we're not checking on that, we can share information inadvertently that we shouldn't have shared. We have a lot of co-occurring model. There's a push for co-occurring models, providing dual diagnosis treatment, both mental health and addictions. And as we all know, part two, which covers the addictions care, has a very different set of requirements, or I guess maybe more stringent set of requirements than the mental health rule does. And so how do we mitigate that and work through that when we're asked to share information? And then from a training perspective, behavioral health staff don't have as much experience or training in billable documentation. So I'm a clinician by nature, and we tend to be a little bit wordy when we're documenting things, and sometimes that can get us in trouble. Or lead us astray, and we just document more than what we should or what we need to for those sessions.
That's a lot of ways for things to go wrong.
Yes, so it's a lot to account for, a lot to manage, and I think that overall we do a good job, but we have to stay on top of it. Certainly. Tim, I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on the differences between mental health, behavioral health care, those issues compared to what you find in other healthcare settings.
I think you've called out some of those distinctions, particularly when we talk about dealing with clients in crisis, when we're looking at the demand for co-occurring models and dealing with court orders and subpoenas. In my experience as a hospital administrator for about 20 years, we didn't have nearly those kinds of challenges when I was working with physical health care providers. So I think you've done a good job highlighting those differences.
There's a lot of issues that you raised there. Is that it, or are there other areas where organizations typically find themselves going astray in terms of non-compliant acts?
I think there's a few others, Adam, that are important to mention. So the treatment plan in behavioral health needs to be updated frequently, and especially needs to be updated if we're going to be providing a service that wasn't previously listed, if we want to bill it. So if we identify skills training as an issue when we're 3 months into care, if we don't update the treatment plan at that time, prior to delivering the first skills training session, that skills training session is not billable. And clinicians get going, they get busy, and sometimes they forget to add those services to the treatment plan, and then we have to go back and unbill all of those. So just reminders are so important around making sure that those treatment plans are updated so that we don't have to go back and address it on the back end. We did talk about breaches and protected healthcare information, so I don't think I'll say anything more about that one that I had written down. The last one, it's a newer issue, and I think newer in the last 15 to 20 years, disclosing protected health information via text messaging. How do we know who we're talking to? How do we make sure that the channels are secure when we hit send or when we receive it? And how do we ensure that what we're conveying is appropriate and covered by releases or circumstances that are allowable? So that's, I feel like in some ways we're just catching up with that, at least here at CCS. I think that we've done a good job in the last several years, but making sure that clinicians and managers and supervisors are really being thoughtful about how that gets communicated, and putting the appropriate protections in place.
Well, and you're not alone in terms of text messages and frankly all the other ways people communicate these days. It's very difficult to get a handle on all of them. Now, Tim, given the constrained resources in this environment, how can compliance teams operate most efficiently?
Well, I think first of all, we need to have access to some external expertise to address those gray area issues that come up. So, for example, when we have some tension between a clinician recognizing what they feel is in the best interests of the client, and the restrictions in the privacy rule or 42 CFR Part 2, it's difficult sometimes to weigh the risks associated with either disclosing or not disclosing PHI when you've got that that tension there that exists. So it's important to have someone that you can turn to help you work through that. Another challenge is having regular training or retraining of staff that perhaps have been educated about compliance issues or HIPAA several years ago. And so they feel like they know what they can and can't do in the way of releasing information or billing services that are provided. And the regulations have changed. So it's important to make sure that they stay current on the changes in the statutes and regulations and are aware of what kinds of restrictions they're faced with. The other thing that is helpful is centralizing functions such as handling of all HIPAA authorizations, releases of information, or responses to subpoena and court orders, making sure that you don't have individual staff members that feel competent in those areas just routinely responding, but rather centralizing those functions. So I think those are some of the areas where we can do a better job.
And are there any distractions that need to be avoided?
Well, Kimberly mentioned one, and I'll just touch on it briefly, and that's the fact that behavioral health staff sometimes are a little more long-winded when it comes to documenting their services. And that can actually harm their ability to be concise, clear, and address the core elements of their encounter documentation. So I think getting away from rambling on about things that aren't really important is important in order to be able to focus on what they need to document to justify the services that were provided and billing for those services.
Well, and I think what's interesting there is, you know, there is always this need to document, and often people do lose track of the fact that too much can be just as problematic as not enough. So finally, Tim, what are some of the emerging issues in behavioral health that compliance teams need to keep their eyes on for the future?
Well, clearly, any changes in the privacy rule and 42 CFR Part 2 are really critical. I think making certain that our staff members are aware of any changes in the regulations. We're looking at some updated regulations to Part 2, for example, that are coming down the line. And because typically the staff members are not keeping track of those things, it's really important that we make sure that they are aware of any modifications in the restrictions that are contained in those regulations. Another one is the increasing use and compliance with state laws governing telemedicine. We know that during the pandemic, we had some federal waivers associated with the provision of telemedicine services. And as those go away, it's important that we're aware of what's happening in the way of changes regarding what we can do in the way of providing services via telemedicine and billing for those services. So I think as we see increased usage of telemedicine for our services, that's going to be an important thing to pay attention to. And the other one that Kimberly mentioned briefly is when we have the expansions of low barrier access models, where the states or the federal government is pushing for increased access to behavioral health services, we want to make sure that we keep our focus on what's medically necessary in implementing those particular treatment models. So that'll be an ongoing challenge as well.
Certainly sounds like it. Well, Tim, Kim, thank you both so much for taking the time to share your insights with us today and also at the 2024 Compliance Institute. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turtletaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.